Hey David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Sean.
It's an absolute pleasure. We've been chatting for a little bit now, and it's finally great to be able to connect. For the three people that don't know who you are, could you give us a quick bio on who you are and what you do?
I think you warrant me with far more fame than the reality. But I'm a competitive CrossFit athlete, and I have been for about just over 8 years now. Two visits to the games. Lots of kind of international, like the big comps experience. Coach, although I've put that to the side now to kind of to focus more on my athletic career, and also programming for some individual athletes as well.
Okay, that's awesome. How did you start in CrossFit? What was your first exposure?
So when I was at university, one of my well, I when I was at university and I was nearing the end of my sports science degree. I wanted to go into the military, specifically into the Royal Marines. I went through the entry process, and like, if you have a degree, you can go. You have an option of going as an officer or enlisted. And I opted to go the officer route. Went through the selection process and was accepted onto basic training. But during that process of trying to like in sharply increase my running volume so I could be better at running and rucking or carrying back weight. I overloaded the knee, got quite a bad knee injury, and then was looking for a way to then I went through the rehab process, and during that was looking for a way to rehab the knee to the point where it could return to full fitness and the demands of the military. And that's how I found CrossFit. And as we know, like the demands of on the body for CrossFit, they match like quite similarly to the demands military wise as well. And so I kind of used that to rehab the knee back to full fitness, or rather like test that it was able to handle like the rigors that would be expected on basic training. And by the time I'd got back to full fitness, I'd qualified for the regionals and been to regionals and discovered that there was this other thing that I was really passionate about that I could be really physical with day to day, and it wouldn't take me away from my family for long periods of time. And so I decided to go that route.
What year was that in?
That was in 2014.
Well, long time ago. And what years did you go to the games?
So I went to the games in a team in 2016, and then again in 2020. Although that was the year where it was like a two stage. The first stage was online, the second stage was at the just the five guys at the ranch.
Right. Yeah, pretty special year, wasn't
And with a whole bunch of other challenges that year as well.
it? Indeed, indeed. 2014, give us a snapshot of what CrossFit looked like through your eyes in 2014 when you first got acquainted with the discipline.
Man, so I kind of like dabbled with it in 2013, but that was mostly just me and some friends at the university gym, like watching YouTube videos, going to the gym, trying to learn how to do a muscle up, trying to learn how to do like butterfly pull-ups, trying to learn how to handstand walk, that kind of thing. Just doing workout after workout, enjoying the variation of the training. And then as it got as the like a quite a rapid introduction to the season, because it was like just doing this for fun. Oh, there's this thing called the Open, I'll give it a shot. Oh, I've qualified for this thing called regionals, I'll give that a shot. 10th at regional was like, oh, okay, well, now I can actually like, now I might actually be good enough to do this properly. And so it was very unstructured. The training was very randomized, very cherry picking, but not cherry picking in the sense of, because I've done a lot of sport before that, basketball and rowing and weightlifting. Cherry picking in terms of like, I'm bad at this, so I need to do this. So I'm going to hammer this. And then I'm bad at this, I need to do this, I'm going to hammer this. So definitely far less structure, far more randomized. And I would also say just generally less professional and a lot more like a lot closer to I'd say like play than more structured, really like strictly structured training.
Do you remember what the first videos were that you found online, or the ones that stick out in your mind?
I can't say that I remember the very first videos that I found, no.
Any ones from that era that stand out to you, or
It
some
was
people in this
mostly a lot
space?
of videos of Froning training in his garage, doing EMOMs of kettlebell swings and burpees and just like a lot of, and that was like the era of like Froning and Khalipa and Chris Spieler, and it was a lot of Graham Holmberg as well. It was a
Yeah.
lot of just like grit and grunt, grindy workouts, you know? And it was also very, that was when I, those are the guys over in the States, and obviously in the UK and in Europe, it was mostly like looking at videos like Stephen Fawcett training and Bjergvin, and Lacey Kovacs was huge then as well.
Yeah.
I think he's from Latvia.
I remember that.
Yeah, the guy that like won the legless rope climb workout because he actually didn't know how to climb with his feet anyway. So all these rope climbs he ever did were legless. So he's been training for these events.
I actually remember that story now that you mention it. Yeah, it's pretty
Yeah, so
crazy.
those are the guys that we were watching in the beginning, I remember.
Did you watch any of those Rob Orlando and what was his name? Camille's husband.
Dave
Da
Limpson. You
Dave
know what? I do
Limpson.
remember watching some Rob Orlando, and I remember him talking about like he wanted to be able to comparing himself to like some sort of feline animal. I don't know if it's like a leopard or a cheetah or something. Like you never see a leopard warm up. Like they're just ready
Was
ever for
it 500 that he had in his on
Yeah,
his
and he's
bar
like
at the entrance of
always
his
having it.
gym? Yeah.
Yeah, deadlift five, walk into the gym, deadlift to 500 pounds, whatever. You
Yeah.
shouldn't need to warm up like a leopard. Never see a leopard need to warm up. It's like, well, slightly different genetics to a leopard, but appreciate the principle.
just build different to be able to just walk into your gym and just pull five off the floor
Yeah,
and just walk
yeah,
on.
yeah, yeah. But he had a cool like that. That was also the other thing as well, that like it was kind of the birth of a lot of, how could you say, like niches within CrossFit as well. Like you didn't just have CrossFit and everyone's programming towards a CrossFit season. You had like I can't remember the name of the guy, but it was like, was it like Power
CrossFit
Athletics,
football, power
CrossFit football,
athlete. It
that's the
was,
one. yeah yeah
yeah. I remember that hybrid training where it was, strength biased CrossFit
yeah
programming. Oh
yeah
fuck, what's his name?
it was an ex, he was an ex-football NFL player, wasn't he?
Deep voice, great guy,
Yeah, big
great
boy.
podcast too. Yeah, I forget his name, but that was the day where you could still be, I guess, biased in
Yeah.
your athletic profile and still make
Yeah.
it to, to the games.
Yeah, exactly. It was and that was maybe to do with like the scoring or the like the distribution of points between events, that like you could be a specialist and still get through. Whereas now you have to be far more balanced.
It probably played that there was far fewer events or far few fewer tests than there are
Yes.
now on at any given stage of the competition.
Yeah, for
How
sure. Yeah.
how many tests did you have to do when you went to regionals the first time?
So I believe it was, I think it was two tests a day.
For 2 or 3 days.
It was either two tests a day, two on the Friday, two, I'm gonna say two on the Friday, two on the Saturday, and or maybe it was like two, it was, I think it was probably actually seven tests in total. I think there might have been, but the first two tests were, it was a hang snatch and then a short break and into a handstand walk. That was the first event. So then that's two scored events. Then we had another event that day, which is three scored events. And then on the Saturday, it was two events. And Sunday, it was two events as well.
How did you cope with that volume of competition and were you already quote unquote fit before that in the sense that you could handle 3 days of massive intensity and volume, or how did you get through it?
So my background was I played basketball for about 7 8 years in the UK. And then I rode for about 4 years. So I had like quite a big aerobic base. And so for me, the volume was never the issue. It was more that kind of like the high-end, high power output, short duration workouts. Those are the ones that I kind of really struggled with. But actually coping with the volume throughout the week, both like the volume within the workout, but also recovering event to event, I felt like my predominantly aerobic background really helped to that. So the volume wasn't really so much of a difficulty. For me, it was more at that point, it was the short, fast events, the heavy stuff, and the gymnastic, like high skill movements. So things like the handstand walk, like the high rep pistols in the second event on the Friday, those kind of things were tough. But the general like amount of volume that we had over the weekend was cool. I think one of my highest scoring events was the 50s event, the like long 50s chipper, and the legless rope climb event, which I'd never climbed a rope before because we didn't have a rope at the gym that we were training. But playing basketball, I had quite a good jump. So it was basically like jump, one, two, slam there at the backboard, sprint back and there and back. And it was, so it was less of a rope climb workout, more of like a run and jump workout. So that was a good one as well. But the volume, yeah, the volume was manageable.
Right. Was that the case? Do you remember what it was like for other guys in at that time?
I think it was, I mean, like you say, you got that was the era where it was a lot more special. There were a lot more specialists or a lot more guys that were like just particularly good in one area. And you did generally find that like the ones that were like quote unquote fitter, like cope with the volume well. And the ones that were like very strong or very powerful tended to drop off over the course of the weekend.
Do you still see that at the high level today, in the grand scheme of things, that people that lack the
No,
capacity? No. Okay.
not at all. I think you still have, well, I'd say like yes, you do see it. It's quite an interesting topic to talk about as well because it's the drop off used to. I think the drop off now is a little bit less related to something physiological and more psychological.
Okay.
So I would say from my experience competing and also like interacting with athletes at competition. And just like watching athletes from the side of competition as well, you see the ones that are like generally across the board, people are far like they're better athletes in every aspect than they were in 2014. You do still have the athletes that tend to drop off over the course of the weekend. And but I think a smaller mind it's a smaller percentage of those athletes that are doing it because physically they're unable to recover between events and between days. And I think it's a larger majority of them that now that are mentally or like more drained and become more fatigued throughout the weekend, whether that be just from having to push hard and work out after workout or deal with the adversity and like the I don't know the intimidation of the event or the other athletes, or that kind of like emotional attachment to performances. So they perform well and they're really happy, and then they perform badly and it drags the mood down. Like you generally see those athletes start to drop off because it just becomes like an extra emotional stress on top of the physical throughout the events.
And I guess there's also the up and down of warming up, cooling down, warming up, cooling down. I remember I never competed personally in CrossFit, but when I used to play rugby and we went to a rugby sevens tournament and you play multiple games throughout the day and over 2 days, by the Sunday when it's time to warm up again, it's just you have to really want to get in there and do it all again almost. We've done it multiple times, and for you guys it's way more than for a handful of games over a weekend, and that must also take its toll mentally.
Yes, and Emma and I have spoken about this a lot about how the warm up, how the evolution of the warm up throughout the competition. And so I'd like to know with you when you were playing rugby sevens, the time and the kind of the like focus that you put into the warm up, how did that differ as the event went on? Did it get longer? Did it get shorter? Was there more or less focus on the warm up?
I played at a very amateur level. So rugby sevens usually also meant drinking all weekend. So by the Sunday it was more about, can we just get going and play so we can start drinking again? That was more the framework that I was in. So I'm sorry, I have nothing of high value to share here.
Nice. Okay. Unfortunately, but it sounded like you had a good time anyway. So you've got
That
that value.
we did, yeah, that we did.
So we
Go
often
for it.
found that like when or we find that competition, like as you get through the weekend, you need less warm up.
Okay.
And I don't know if that differs between athletes, but I generally find that, like, when you first get there, it's probably not that long before you've flown out there, depending on the time difference, how long you've been out there for. You've like been resting and recovering the days beforehand, so although you're staying like stable and mobile, you haven't maybe had as much heavy load through you or as high intensity as you would do normally. So things are just generally a little bit like stiffer than they would be usually. And then as the weekend goes on, because it's like a really good warm up, intense workout, solid cool down, complete rest between events. You need like less and less warm up between as the events go on. So usually by the end of the weekend, the last event is pretty much just get in there and just do the movements before the workout starts and you're ready to go.
Very interesting. What kind of cool down do you usually put in place after tests in a competition setting?
Usually somewhere between 10 to 15 minutes cyclical work, ideally on an echo bike or an assault bike, just because it gets like the arms and the legs moving. But if there's only like a rowing machine available or a C2 bike, then I would use that as well.
Mm-hmm. What's the value, in your opinion, of a cool down after an intense effort within a competition setting?
I think physically transitioning your body from that level of like intensity down to like more of a resting state, clearing any like residual like lactate in the muscle, bringing heart rate down and breathing rate down gradually, so it's not just like a sudden stop, food in, and then you're lying down in the bed. Just like flush, it feels very good to like flush the muscles out of anything that could be in there that could be hampering recovery. And mentally, it also gives you, equally as importantly, it gives you time to transition from the workout that for the competition arena setting and what's just happened. You've got that 5-10 minute, that 10-15 minute cool down, and then like the journey back to wherever you're staying to kind of mentally, what's the word? Kind of like come to terms with the event, like accept like how it went, good or bad, and then put it to bed so that you can then move on to thinking about the next event.
When you're working with an athlete in a competition setting, how do you recommend that they spend their time between events?
Oh, good question. It's very individual, because people respond differently to different things in terms of like what gets them the best, like the most recovered, and what gets them like mentally, I suppose mentally refreshed and the most recovered between events. I think the principle is that you want to get your body, your mind and your body into a state where it can recover as well as possible from the previous event and prepare for the next event. So for some people, that might be some social interaction. It might be like chatting with friends and other competitors or like messages on Instagram. For other people, it may be the opposite. It may be complete removal from other people, like a slightly darkened room, silence, maybe like a little bit of light music, some reading, have a nap. But whatever you feel like gets you physically and mentally as restored as possible. I will say that there's, I think, a trap that people often fall into is getting caught up in the competition atmosphere when they're not actually competing. And so between events, they feel the obligation to go around to all the stalls, to like prioritize going to see their sponsors and hang out at the stall there by like taking photos and chatting with other athletes. And then you get to the next event, you think, shit, I haven't eaten as much as I should have. I'm still like a little bit, I'm more sore than I should be because I haven't actually just laid down and rested. Mentally, I'm a bit like a foggy because I haven't had time to like decompartmentalize from that event previously. So I think that's a trap that amateurs usually fall into.
It's something that came to mind when you mentioned that. I think it was Greg Everett from Catalyst Weightlifting.
Yeah, Catalyst Athletics. Yeah,
Catalyst Athletics. Club, yeah. And I think he was talking about that where, or I don't know if it was him because I don't know how much he was competing at the time, but somebody who coached and who was competing as well, and he talked about the Arnold and went there with his weightlifters and, you know, coached them through the Friday, the Saturday, and on Sunday it was his turn to go, and he had nothing left because emotionally he was completely drained from watching competitions, helping his athletes, and battery was literally at zero on Sunday. He had nothing in the tank.
Oh man, we in 2000, and so after we went to the games in 2020, that season, like with everything that happened within CrossFit and Greg Glassman and COVID and like all the run up and like, is the games on? Is the games not on? If it is on, do we even want to do it? And then like, it's so emotionally draining. The year after that, I actually took off and I didn't compete. I didn't even train CrossFit for about a year and a half. And during that time, Emma was still competing. And she had the previous season off. So she had a really big off season, prepped to have a really good season. And she had a brilliant one. And so during that time, I spent a lot of my season supporting Emma with her competitions. So I was basically her coach, and like throughout the season, but also at competitions as well. And like the challenge of being a coach, like the stress mentally, emotionally, like even physically, of like just having to like run around back and forth from place to place. I was absolutely exhausted after competitions. And like you go there with the plan of like, okay, we're trying to do as much like training as I can to kind of keep things going while I'm there. And by the end of it, like you've done 30,000 steps a day, you're absolutely knackered. Like training is not even like within like question. It's funny, you still carry all of the stress that you would carry as if you were competing. But because you are not the one on the floor, you don't have the control over the performance. So it's almost like a worse situation mentally as well.
Right. Yeah. Zebras don't get ulcers. So essentially, if our minds think that we're stressed, then we're stressed no matter what our body is actually doing. That makes total sense. And I guess that extends to, you know, any work environment. I find it with my work day to day as well. If I don't mind, if I don't pay attention to how much I work and how much I control that, and I'm always all out all the time, well, guess what? It just doesn't work. And the same principles that we have to apply in training, we have to apply to ourselves at other levels as well, because anytime you're focused and dedicated on a task, whether it's physical, mental, if there's some emotional involvement there, it's going to cost you something, and you have to deal with that cost.
Yeah. That was something that I didn't learn until quite late on in my athletic career, like the idea about, instead of it's not a case of you have like a cup for life, for your like work stress, and then you have a cup for your relationship stress, and then you have a cup for your training stress, and then your hobby stress. Like it's just one cup, and it's a fixed volume.
Yep.
And if you've got all these other things filling that up, you can't expect to then also perform and recover with training as well. Like you have to, as you say, like pay attention to the fact that you've already filled your stress capacity with all of these other things, and that needs to be paid attention to.
Yeah, and I guess that's probably one of the biggest differentiating factor between a professional athlete and somebody who's maybe aiming to get there, is that the professional has the luxury, so to speak, to shape their environment and their day-to-day routines around their training. They don't have to fit their training into an already busy schedule. And we know the importance of recovery. I mean, everybody can train a lot and can train hard, but can you actually recover from that work to adapt and get better?
Absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't agree more.
It's, I guess Matt Fraser always used to say, I hate traveling, because when I travel, I don't train as well. I don't rest as well. I don't eat as well. And those are all the things that are going to, you know, make me better for next year. So what strategies do you try to implement with your athletes around everything outside of training, lifestyle, whatever you want to call it? What are some of the building blocks that allow your athletes to perform at their best and manage their environment?
So I think, first of all, you have to ask yourself, what is the priority in my life at this time? And if, like for myself and for Emma, the priority is our performance. And so with that in mind, it's very easy to make decisions throughout the day, because it's a case of just simply asking the question, is this going to help my performance or is this going to hinder my performance? And as you say, like the difference between someone like professional and amateur is that amateurs are almost like they're having to balance this commitment that they have with also the other commitments in their life that pay the bills. Whereas a professional has the, I don't want to say luxury, because it's earned, it's built,
of course,
but they have the situation where they don't have to make the compromises. So they could just have like clean slate. How do I structure my day so that everything I'm doing is going to help my performance? So I think first of all, it's a case of asking a question like, how committed are you to this? Is this the number one thing in your life? Because if it isn't, that's absolutely fine. But the issues arise when you want it to be a priority, or you say out loud that it is a priority, but internally you're aware that actually you have these other commitments that you either want to pursue more or you are forced to pursue more. And then it becomes a conflict, because you can't put two things at the top of the list. And then it's a case of then analyzing based off of that what your priorities are. Like, everything that I do in my day, does this fit with that number one priority? If it doesn't, can I change it? If it does, brilliant. And if it doesn't, is it a case of like this has to be removed, or is this like a necessary like compromise that I have to take in order to like to balance my life and my passion?
Is there anything from that perspective that came from your rowing background? And the reason I ask is that I have a recollection of something. I think it was the British rowing team preparing for the 2012 Olympics, and the only question in everybody's mind was, is it going to make the boat go faster? And if it doesn't, throw it out. If it does, keep it in.
So I think probably yes and no, because why I rowed at Oxford Brookes was a very high level of rowing, and it was a direct feeder to Leander, which is another rowing club, but also the Olympic Rowing Development Squad as well. So we had a lot of guys at Oxford Brookes who were either on the Olympic squad or very like soon after the university went there. So there definitely was like that strong link, and so that very similar mindset to what you've just said there. But I think that whether because of like lack of experience or lack of direction or just like the sport being quite old-fashioned in its approach, that discipline was definitely there in the sessions, and it was definitely there around the training, but away from the training, definitely wasn't there. So
Interesting.
the lifestyle was, in terms of like sleep, nutrition, like how often and like how long you're going out for at night, I don't think those questions were really asked. Otherwise, behaviors probably would have been quite different.
That's good to know. I've never had it behind the scenes, so I appreciate that.
I mean, rowing and rugby, like the behaviors are like identical. So
Yep.
it's so yeah, like the that side of things, I don't think was that question was really being asked so much. But definitely in terms of like, are you willing to get up early? Like, are you willing to do these sessions? Are you willing to change your position in the boat because it makes the boat go faster, even if it's not necessarily the position that you want to be rowing in? Yeah, that definitely was a kind of a principle that was strong there. And I think that you probably have that question in your mind if you've come from any like disciplined or very like almost like elite level of sport, because that is essentially like what you're trying to build your life around. Does it make me better at my sport or my craft or not?
I wanted to linger on the rowing for a minute. To what extent do you think coming from this endurance background helped you in your first years of CrossFit? Or if you could choose and had to do it all again, would you rather come from a weightlifting background or some other sport?
I think it helped me massively. Yeah, massively. Because back then, the loads were heavy, but they weren't really heavy enough to stop you in a workout. And the gymnastics were, that had a range of, it still was like low to high skill, but that even the highest skill again wasn't enough to stop you in a workout. So you could get by from just being really fit. And we saw that from the athletes that some of the athletes that did really well then. Athletes like Chris Spieler, who is fantastic at gymnastics, but also extremely fit guy. Athletes like Sam Briggs as well on the female side. These are athletes that today probably wouldn't be excelling as much as they did then, just because they would get stopped by the heavier loads and by the very complex gymnastics, one or the other. But I think back then, because the loads were lighter, the gymnastics were a little bit easier. If you were just fit, you could just plow through the workout and get like a good time.
When it comes to training and tolerating and assimilating the volume of training, would the answer be the same, that you're happy that you came from this endurance background back then? Or was there not even enough training at that point to necessitate a huge work capacity?
There was definitely enough training, because back then it was, especially as it usually is when you first get into a sport, it's like the more the better. What is periodization? Why do I need to taper? Is that even a real thing? So yeah, no, they're definitely, I think it definitely helps both in terms of because like the more when you, I think I still had like the like I had like the raw fitness, but just not applicable to the CrossFit movement. So what I needed was just a lot of time and a lot of repetition, learning movements, and and doing the movements. And by having that fitness behind me, I could tolerate doing a large volume of training, which then meant I could pick up skills sooner than someone who would need to do shorter sessions or less sessions throughout the week. I would say that if there was anything that I wish I'd done that I didn't do, it would be gymnastics. Because I think that from playing basketball, like I have good body awareness, hand-eye coordination. I generally like I pick up skills quite well, but I think there's an aspect of gymnastics that's very specific to moving your body, like a level of understanding of how to move your body that you can't really pick up unless you do like very structured gymnastics. So that's the only thing I think I would change if I could.
Now, if you were to if you were to enter the sport today, would you still favor an endurance background, or would you favor a strength or a weightlifting background? Give it.
To be honest, I don't really feel like it matters so much.
Hmm.
I don't feel like it matters so much. I
Because
think,
both are going to take a lot of time to develop to the highest level, so you have to just be in it for a few years anyway.
I think, I mean, I've had the, I think, I've come from the endurance, more of an endurance background and pushed myself and done a lot of training at the other end of the continuum. So for me, naturally, like I naturally want to say, I feel like I want to say I would prefer to be come from that like weightlifting background and be just like really strong and like naturally just so good at gymnastics and just be able to move myself and weight through space so efficiently and have a huge back squat and clean and like press to handstand is just like it's just like a warm-up exercise. Like it's that though I think I would like to say that because I have come from the opposite. So that's the thing I've had to work really hard on. But I think if it was the other way and I'd come from a bit more of like a power-based background, I would probably wish that I'd done the endurance stuff because like sitting on a rowing machine or a bike or running for like hours on end at set heart rates is significantly less engaging than like getting to lift heavy weights.
And you're choosing your words kindly too. Less
Yeah.
engaging is a euphemism. So we've been talking about CrossFit competition, the sport of CrossFit, so far in our conversation. There's an interesting point you brought up in our exchanges before we got on the show is the difference between the sport of CrossFit and the philosophy or the methodology of CrossFit. How do you see those two elements existing together?
So this is a point that I've thought a bit more about recently after listening to a bit more work from a bit like more media and product from people within like the hybrid athlete sphere, which is probably like as close as it gets to CrossFit in terms of like the demands training wise, and although they don't have seem to have as much like official competition like competitive wise as well, and I think that there is a bit of a misunderstanding in terms of the CrossFit as a sport versus CrossFit as a training methodology. And I think there's also a misunderstanding that a lot of amateurs make as well. People that are recreationally doing CrossFit or people that are outside of the sport completely. But CrossFit as a sport, CrossFit as a training methodology is a lot of variation and it is arguably like very like randomized. And the idea is that you are giving your body exposure to a bunch of different stimuluses, different movement patterns, throughout a week of training, and at that intensity and that volume, that's a very good way to train. Like you're not going to get a huge adaptation in one direction, but in terms of staying fit and healthy and I suppose ready to be able to take on different challenges, like it's a great way to train. And also it's going to keep you really engaged as well. Like to turn up to a class and have something different to do is going to be a nice contrast to what most people's lives is, which is a fairly consistent challenges day to day. But at the elite level of the sport, anyone who is doing this sport competitively and training well, understands that you cannot do CrossFit to get better at CrossFit, or you cannot solely do CrossFit to get better at CrossFit. The approach that is taken is that we break down what are the different facets of the sport. The further away from competition we are, the more we train those facets individually to get them as good as they can. So, for instance, training gymnastics, training weightlifting, training different movement pathways of different skills, different like monostructural work, focusing on energy system development in isolation. And then as it gets closer and closer to the competition, those different elements get mixed together more and more until eventually we get all the way to the competition, and that taper, that where it's the most specific that it can get, turns into CrossFit. And I think that that's something that's misunderstood. I think it's mainly misunderstood by people who are either like amateurs in the sport or just doing it recreationally, and what their experience of CrossFit is only the CrossFit classes and CrossFit workouts or CrossFit.com. But also people that are just entirely from like outside of the sport and may and have like very limited experience at the of or like viewing of the higher levels.
Yeah, it's really a very interesting topic that I like to bring up, especially with people like you who have been in the sport for, you know, almost a decade, because at its foundation, CrossFit is a very minimalist strategy of training. It's minimal effective dose, and that's, I think, outlined at least once in the original CrossFit documents, where it's not about how much you can do, it's how little can you do and still get better week after week and then keep training. And now we, you know, simply by virtue of the demands of the sport itself, we're pretty much at the polar opposite now on the sports side, which is how much volume can you tolerate? And then in competition, same thing. It's not about one test. It's about, you know, 3, 4, 5 days now, where you have to be able to repeat those efforts and perform at the highest level. How do you explain that, given how different those two things are? So they have the same name, or part of their name is same, which is CrossFit, but they're almost polar opposites in the way that they are implemented. How do you explain the fact that this is still not understood by a vast majority of people, or not recognized maybe?
I think because failure to understand the differences, I think, is more a failure to understand the process by which you get better at these things. And by that, what I mean is the process of the training, the adaptation that needs to get better, that needs to take place in order to get better at the different elements of CrossFit. And if you do just do CrossFit workouts, you are going to get better at CrossFit, like you're doing like a very specific part of the most specific thing you can do for the sport. But just like in any sport, you can't, if you're running 400 meters, you can't just run 400 meter repeats to get better, and that will not like release your full potential as a 400 meter sprinter, because inevitably something is going to be the weak link there that is not going to be prioritized in running 400 meters, but is going to be the limiting factor in how fast that you can go. And so if you don't take that thing and train it in isolation, it's always going to be the thing that stops you from running faster. And the dose stimulus that you get just from running the 400 meters on that particular thing isn't going to be enough to improve it compared to the other aspects. And it's the same thing in CrossFit. Eventually, you are going to run into the case where the limiting factor in you being able to move forward in a workout isn't going to be how well you can breathe. It's going to be, can you clean that weight? It's going to be, can you remain unbroken on this gymnastic movement? Can you even do this gymnastic movement? And unless you take the time away from the sport, or time away from just the traditional metcons to train those things, they're not going to improve. So they're always going to be the limiting factor. And that's then what's going to slow you down. So I think it's more a case of not understanding that, that like how that process works. And then I think once people do understand that, they could probably see, oh, okay, right. So now I can understand why to get better at heavy Fran, I actually need to do more front squats, because it's my leg strength that's stopping me from being able to thrust 80 kilos, not by how fit I am.
Do you find that this is one of the biggest areas for development currently for competitors? Maybe not at the elite level, but in general, is maybe doing a little bit less testing, especially far away from competition, and actually having a season?
Are you suggesting that people shouldn't go balls to the wall every workout and they should actually periodize their year?
I wouldn't dare to say that. I don't know what periodization is. No, you said it didn't exist.
Dangerous talk, yeah. I don't think tapering's not even a real thing. The I think that is. Yeah. It is a I think over time, as people have become more educated and just generally become a bit more aware of like what's necessary at the higher levels of the sport. I suppose like the ignorance is reduced a bit over time. I feel more it's a case now of, yeah, it's still like maybe it's that kind of like for us, for instance, like when we're training at the box, members will sometimes ask us and say like, oh, like how long do you spend doing like rehab? Not rehab, but like how long do you spend doing like warm-ups and rehab and prep and stuff like that? And like how much time do you spend doing like weightlifting or like what are you doing today? And if the answer is not like, oh, we're doing this workout, it's a bit like a surprise of like, oh, you're only doing like an EMOM of gymnastics and like some upper body strength work. And so I think there's still, it mostly comes from that assumption that to get the best at this, I just have to do the thing, which isn't an ignorant, it's not like a dumb thing to think, right? You want to get better at something, you generally do the thing. But I think the other half of it is a lot of is born from ignorance. And I think it's born from or maybe not ignorance is the wrong word. Maybe it's a case of people outside of the sport of CrossFit that don't know enough about the sport of CrossFit and maybe don't have the kind of, I don't know if humility or curiosity is the right word to just ask. And so like the assumption is made that like, CrossFit's stupid. CrossFit's stupid. They don't know what they're doing because all they do is CrossFit and like they can't do pull-ups and like, you're never gonna get fitter just doing what they're doing. Instead of asking the question like, actually, some of the stuff these people are doing is pretty impressive. Maybe I should ask like, how are they training? Is it the same at the elite level as it is at the amateur level? And the answer is no, as it is in pretty much every single sport.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I feel like especially the elite levels of the sport have, I guess, evolved away from the original, you know, back to what you were saying, and 2014 was probably still in that mindset of counterculture. CrossFit is different. We don't need to train like other sports. We vary our stuff all the time, and this is how we get better. And I think the treacherous thing is that it works at the beginning, right? It works great at the start because it's new. And because you, assuming you don't have a huge engine yet, you can't really do too much damage by going hard often. But then once you have the engine, now if you don't have the chassis to go with it, now you're in trouble. And whereas in the beginning stages, okay, I need to get better, so I'll do a little harder and a little bit more. And that works. And that usually works in the first year, 2 years, maybe 3 years. But I think what's difficult is once you get to a certain level of strength, of skill, of capacity, sometimes to get to the next level, it's not about going harder. It's actually maybe dropping, you know, going up a gear, but dropping the revs just a little bit so that you can keep accelerating.
I like that analogy that you've just used there about the engine and the chassis. It's I like that one. And it's also like the what you said about like going hard in the beginning, like you can just go like max out on every workout and gradually get better. Yes, like absolutely, as you've just said there, it does work for a limited amount of time. But also I think after a while you realize that you going hard then wasn't actually like compared to you going 100% now is like you realize actually I was probably going more like 85 or 90% now then. And also because you again to use the analogy of the engine and the chassis, if you were to take that what might be easier to understand because CrossFit is so many different things combined into one challenge of a workout, if you were to take one of those things, say just powerlifting, like a deadlift or bench press or back squat. If you were to get an elite level powerlifter and an amateur level powerlifter, or even someone who's just recently started training in that way, they could max out pretty much every week, and every week they will PB, and every week they'll come back in almost fully recovered. If you get an elite level powerlifter to truly max out, like he's done for about 3 weeks. Like that's he's not lifting within 90% of that for a very long time, and that's because like in he's much closer to his like absolute potential. And the same thing goes for CrossFit. And it's the same reason why after a weekend of competition, it is necessary to take that rest because the higher the level that you are, the more of your full capacity you've reached. And so the bigger the toll that max effort takes on you. And if you extrapolate that then to training and you're just doing workouts every day, like you're quickly, as you said, you're going to run yourself into the ground.
Yeah, it's very interesting, especially because at the beginning, CrossFit was very counter-cultural and just its nature. And then obviously it went and it grabbed, you know, information from the weightlifting crowd and from the strongman and from the endurance folks. And now it seems like, and again, very much at the highest level of the sport for years now, but at the amateur level, people start to understand that I need to structure my season based on my goals. If I want to be competitive, I can't just, you know, compete every 2 weeks and then do that all year round and expect to get better. Cause like you said, even though we agreed that tapers don't exist. Okay. You have a taper for the week before. And like you said, you need to at the very least emotionally recover the week after, but also probably physically. So for every competition, that's 2 weeks that you didn't train or develop. And if you do 10 of those in the year, that's 20 weeks. That's 40% of your year where you didn't actually get better.
Yeah. For every competition that you do, there is a sacrifice of development. And that's the reason why you have to pick and choose your competitions carefully, so that they aid your long-term development towards the ultimate goal, whatever that is, and they don't hinder it by just taking away weeks of training.
How do you determine if an athlete needs to compete more to get better at competing or needs to compete less to get better at the sport?
Yeah, that's a very tricky one. That's a very tricky one, because there are athletes that fall into both either of those categories quite clearly. Like the ones that tend to, like, they physically have all of the attributes that are necessary to do well at a competition. And in training, they put up scores fairly consistently that are competitive, but they lack the competitive experience to then execute at competition. And whether that be like mentally dealing with the pressures of competition, whether it be with like a mental resilience aspect of being able to consistently perform a competition, or a like there's so many different things that go into it in terms of like awareness on the field, pacing, like just discipline between events and what you're doing. Those are the kind of things that if an athlete lacks, I think what they need is more competition experience. If there's like a really big discrepancy between what they can do in training and what they can do in competition, whereas if it's a case of they usually perform fairly well in competition, but their training numbers and their like performance between competition doesn't seem to really improve, it probably means that they're not getting enough of a, like a solid training block to make improvement, because it's just being interrupted by competitions.
Now, if we look at the next level up, somebody who's, you know, good at the sport and just needs to go and compete and is maybe competing near the top, when do you start looking left and right at what others are doing in a competition setting? Is that reserved for Matt and maybe the two or three people at the very tippy top that can just, you know, look at what's going on in the Jumbotron and decide to push the pace or not? And do some athletes get maybe pulled into this and trying to compete against others before executing their own race?
So this is an interesting topic that Emma and I discuss a lot. Emma Tal competes. She's competed in. We're very opposite in how we compete, and there's benefits to both. So when I compete, I'm very aware of everyone else on the field, and I use that to my advantage with pacing and knowing where I am at any point within a workout. If I can slow down, if I need to speed up, perhaps it's a new movement, I can keep aware of like how, what kind of technique are the other guys using. Could that perhaps be better if it's something that I've never done before? Whereas Emma is very much in her own lane, doesn't pay attention to anyone else, has her pace, sticks to her pace, and goes for it. And both of them work. But there are advantages to both that you think you can pick and use. My background coming from basketball, a game sport, so I like was for many years training, keeping aware of other people. And so that carried over into CrossFit, that awareness, whereas Emma, 12 years competitive swimming in her lane, underwater, can't see anyone else, can't hear anything else. And so it couldn't be more like there's like literally the definition of staying in your lane. So I think that there's advantages to be taken from both. And we both recognize that and try and picked up things that the other one does to use to their advantage. So Emma, for instance, has become more aware of who else is on the field, and so then can use things like understanding where someone is. Can she catch them? Does she need to pull away? Can she afford to slow down? Are they perhaps using a different technique that she's using? Is it working out to be better? And for myself, it's been a case of sometimes being less aware, more focused on what I'm doing, not getting flustered by other people, and kind of sticking to my game plan where necessary as well.
For someone who would be very much either like you or like Emma at one end of the spectrum or the other, what are some of the downsides of either being stuck in your lane or just focused on your lane only versus looking around too much?
So I think the primary disadvantage of looking around too much is that you can get put if you, I suppose, like lack the focus or the discipline to stick to your to also consider your own game plan at the same time. You can sometimes get pulled along. You can get pulled along at a pace that you didn't intend to go at, or you can get led astray by someone who's slowing down. You can get distracted. You can almost like get more stressed because someone is 2 foot further ahead of you than you predicted. So I think that's the main thing, is just getting pulled out of your own game plan if you're aware and you don't have that discipline there. In terms of staying in your lane, I think it's more a case of like missing opportunities. Like if you're not aware of what's going on in the field, perhaps you're way ahead and you don't need to be pushing as hard as you're pushing, and you can afford to slow down and save yourself a bit of fatigue. Or you're just behind, and if you're just aware of that person who is a little bit ahead of you, 1, 2 reps ahead of you could have sped up your cycle rate for the last 10 reps and beaten them and gained yourself a place.
Is there an approach that is better suited for people that are beginning in competition?
I think it very much depends on your character. I think it's if you're someone that's quite easily flustered or stressed by the potential of other people beating you, or you find competitions quite like bring you quite a bit of anxiety or stress, then you're probably someone who could do with just staying in your own lane, focusing on your game plan, and then like after a few times of getting your ass handed to you, realize that it's actually okay if I lose, and it's actually more beneficial if I lose because I've learned more than if I win. Then that's probably the approach to take for you. But I think if you're someone that's just like head down, go for it, don't consider anything or anyone else around, and you spot a few times that, oh, actually, if I just paid attention to what else was happening there, I could have picked something up, then you're probably someone that needs to be a little bit more aware. Because the same thing goes for like the people who are a little bit too aware, or a little bit I don't want to say, yeah, a bit more aware of what's going on. You can use things to your advantage, like being a bit more aware of your judge and your judge's counting, and perhaps your judge warning you about something like you need to move forward, you need to step back. Did you get a no rep? Did you not get a no rep? Whereas sometimes that lack of awareness can do the opposite, where you then, because you're so in your own lane, you're so like in your own bubble, you almost don't realize that your judges, you've finished the reps and you need to advance forward, or you haven't received a no rep and you don't need to repeat a rep. I think that's that. Yeah, it's very different for different people. Like for instance, at Madrid, a very costly no rep for Emma was on the or rep for Emma was on the clean an event with power cleans and heavy double unders, and it was a really short, fast event, and she'd done the reps, and she had not been she wasn't aware enough, or say, of the ruling of her judge, and she was pretty confident she'd done the rep, but she wasn't sure, so she did another rep just to be sure, which in an event that had a total of 15 reps on the barbell is like, it's quite a big amount of work to be doing extra, and she ended up losing a few places because of the time that it took to do that extra rep. Whereas if she'd been aware enough of what was going on around her and her judge being clearer, then maybe she wouldn't have done that extra rep. She could have saved herself some time. So like it's a bit of a it's a learning process constantly to see like how do I need to adjust my tactic to be better.
I want to switch topics, but I want to stay in the realm of competition to begin with, and we'll switch that up afterwards. If we talk about nutrition in the context of competing in CrossFit, what are some of the mistakes that you see competitors make around nutrition during a weekend competition?
Man, a lot. I think the biggest mistake, or like the thing that summarizes the mistake, is not understanding the demands on your body that these workouts are creating and the fuel that that requires.
Would you say that most on that point, would you say that most competitors underfuel? Or misfuel? What's the
I don't know if it's an under or a mid. It's probably a combination of both, but
Okay.
it's probably an underfueling, as in not basically not enough carbs, not enough care taken to fuel and refuel, an under appreciation of the effects that that can have, not taking on enough carbohydrate throughout a weekend, not taking on enough electrolytes throughout the weekend, or being aware of your hydration enough throughout the weekend, taking on too much fat, and also at the wrong times as well. And even like an unnecessary prioritization of protein as well throughout a competition too.
Why
So
is protein not at the top of the food chain, no pun intended, during a competition?
the reason why protein is an important aspect during training is because that is the thing that's going to help your muscles. That's one of the things that's going to help your muscles recover, build, develop, grow in response to the training that you've done. Whenever you eat something, whatever macro it is, protein, carb, or fat, that takes up calories that you have in your day to eat. It also takes up stomach space that you have to eat as well. When you're at competition, the intensity of the workouts, the duration of the competition, the workouts, the warm-ups, the cool down, the travel time mean that you're probably going to be struggling to eat or have like a lower appetite than you would do normally, which then means that you have to be even more selective with what you are eating because you have less of it available to eat, both in terms of hunger and stomach space and time. The function of protein during that competition is going to be the same as it is in training to help you recover from the events, but it's not going to have as much of an immediate impact as it is in terms as carbohydrates are, which are going to help fuel you for the event and also going to help you recover massively as well. So it's not so much a case that the protein's not important, but it's just like if you were to isolate that window and you have a limited amount of time to eat, limited stomach space to eat, protein versus carbs is going to help you a lot less. It's going to fuel you less. It's going to help you recover less. And you could effectively like very much restrict the amount of protein that you could eat throughout the 2 or 3 day competition and experience little to probably no muscle loss at all or strength loss at all, provided that you're still eating enough on either side.
And I guess you did mention that it's not easy to ease in a competition setting. There's everything that goes, with the competing, the emotionals around it, and then protein being satiating too, that might even drive you to eat less than what you should.
That's a good point. I haven't thought about that as well, but yeah, absolutely. Like it's going to curb your appetite, which is definitely not what you want during a competition when your appetite's even already low. So on the contrary, you want to be eating things that are going to be easily digestible and easy and quick to get in, things that you would actually enjoy eating. For us, that's a lot of cereal, low fat milk as well. Yeah, agreed on the protein for sure. Yeah.
When you were saying carbs and electrolytes before, it just made me think of triathletes, and essentially they have to feed, on the bike, on the run. You guys have some time in between events to do that, but at the end of the day, it's the same thing. It's a quite a prolonged effort if we take into account that there are usually spikes of intensity within a day, but it's still a considerable amount of work spread out over a few days, and that we could probably learn a few things from endurance disciplines where feeding is, one of the main concerns when it comes to performing at the end of your race, because you might be the best on day one, but if you have nothing left in the socks in day three, then not so good.
Absolutely, yeah. I think taking the approach, or the understanding that it is an endurance sport in terms of the amount of volume that you're doing over the course of a weekend, really does help with understanding why you need to do certain things.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to get people to realize the demands of the sport and looking away from the competition itself. And obviously, like you said, the competitions nowadays, especially at the higher levels, there's a lot of volume. So you have to consider that. But besides this, if you just look at the training that's required to get good at your sport, and then you have to fuel for your training as well, because it's your training that's going to get you better at your sport that is going to allow you to compete at your highest potential. So if you don't think it's an endurance sport, count how many hours a week you're training, And then you're going to see that one, you need work capacity, and two, you need fuel for all that work that you're putting in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so, like a fail-safe way to figure out to like what you need to eat, and also, I mean, what you need to eat is a whole nother. What you need to eat day to day and doing training throughout competition specifically is a whole other thing we can go into. But in terms of just developing an understanding of why you need to eat certain foods and like an appreciation for how much carbohydrate you actually should take on for your training for competition is just to measure, like to use data, like the numbers tell the story. If you track your macros that you're eating and you track your body weight, and you track your performance in the gym and also your perception as well of how things are, you can play around with the numbers and you'll probably quickly find out that for most people, like more carbohydrate you eat, provided that your body weight is staying stable, like probably the better your performance and your recovery is going to get. And I would guess that majority of people that are starting to make their entry into the higher levels of competition will probably find that they're under eating on carbs and probably overeating on fat and protein.
Yeah, and that's probably, like you said, the case in competition, but even outside, and especially sometimes if you're putting long hours of training back to back, that's something we've started implementing with Claudia and Marie, her nutritionist. So obviously collaborating with Marie and talking about those principles of nutrition within training. And you know, if you're doing a weightlifting session and you don't get to do two or three that day, so you have to put something on the back end, and so you end up sitting on the bike for an hour, and you just did a weightlifting for an hour and a half and then an hour on the bike, that's 2.5 hours with some intensity at the front end. And if you don't fuel during that session, like you said, your rating of perceived exertion is going to be higher, and your performance is just not going to be the same, and your recovery for the next day of training or the next training session is going to be impaired. So you have to consider that in a competition setting, but also in training, around training, obviously, but inside of training, depending on the duration and the content of the session.
And that's the key thing as well, isn't it? Like the duration and the content of the session. For anyone listening, this isn't your go ahead to just like fill your face with as much food as possible because you're doing one 40-minute conditioning session a day. Like that's, you have to earn the calories, you have to have the need for them. I think it was Charles Poliquin that was said something about like if the skin on your stomach isn't basically like foreskin, like as thin as penis skin, that you should not be taking on any carbohydrate after the session. You should only be eating for protein. Like that's like, I think that's the other extreme, right? Like you need to have a healthy enough body composition, like fat percentage, to be able to actually stand the volume of training. But you also need to be doing enough volume of training to warrant the calories and the carbs as well. And that's why I think tracking is the best way to do it, because it'll quickly show you probably after like a case. But if you're tracking macros and body weight and taking note of your performance in the gym, after 1 or 2 weeks, you're quickly going to see if like your what kind of changes you perhaps could be making to your nutrition.
That's another topic that I think is really interesting, is how lean should one stay year round if they want to perform at their best level? Obviously there's genetics that play a big role in that, and how lean you're going to just walk around regardless of how you eat. But is there a consideration for you of, depending on the time of season, we might be able to afford being a couple, you know, kilos heavier because maybe it's better for the joints, maybe it helps us with recovery a little bit. How do you see that aspect of the sport?
So I actually have, this is the first year where I've tried to make like really deliberate changes to body composition within the season, whereas usually it's been something that I've done before the season. And I think, as you've said there, like there's no key number as to like, you should be this fat percentage, like you should not be this lean or feel this way at any time of the season, because it's very individual. And some people just naturally carry more fat than others in different places as well. So I don't think it's not as simple as a straight answer, but I think that the closer to competition, so the further away from competition that you are, I think is probably a better time to be making substantial changes to body composition, because then you are going to reach your desired body composition far enough away from the far enough away from the competition that you can then have more time training at that body composition. And from like from a I can't we'll call it like a dieting perspective, your body has more time to hit make that a set point, to make that like you've got more times at maintenance calories, you've got more time sustaining those calories in that body weight, so that it then naturally falls at you naturally stay at that body weight by the time you get to competition. And you've also got enough time to recover from the diet fatigue that you will incur from having to change your body weight to that. And by that, what I mean is, if you've lost weight, and anyone who's done like a structured diet for a period of time, focusing on reducing their body fat, will know that at the end of that, you do get diet fatigue. And that is both a physical and a mental thing. And it takes time to recover from that. And you definitely don't want to be going hard, like through a cutting phase, and then go straight into competition without having settled at that body weight, still carrying that diet fatigue, because it's another stress on the body. So I think that most of the body composition changes should be made early on in the season, so you can maximize how much time you have training at that body weight before you get to competition.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. Don't do a UFC style cut 2 days before just to
Man, it's rough some of the stuff that those guys do, yeah.
I know. And don't, never mind the mental aspect of things and concussions and hydration on the brain and what that does, which is another topic altogether. But on the other side of things, how do you prevent from being too lean? What how lean is too lean for performance?
Are we saying lean as in, so when we say lean, are we assuming that how lean you are has a correlation to has a correlation to performance, or has a correlation to fatigue?
Let's let maybe let me rephrase. What are the signs of your body composition impairing your health and thus impacting your performance?
Okay, so I would say that from my experience, both in with myself and with athletes I work with, if maintaining a body certain body composition is causing you stress in terms of the mental stress and an unhealthy relationship with food, it needs to change. If it is causing you, is it if it is hampering your ability to recover from training or perform in subsequent training sessions, it needs to change. If it's having a significantly or if it's having a negative impact on something like sleep, for instance, that definitely needs to change. And I think the most obvious ones are effects on sleep, effects on mood. As we know, like for if you've gone through a cutting phase, at some point you get pretty antsy, you get pretty easily pissed off by things. And if it's causing you to, if you're forced to essentially under fuel for a training session, like you're going to feel that, you're going to feel it, you're going to see it in your performance, you're going to feel it in your the perceived exertion for that session as well. I'd say that those are probably the main ones. I wouldn't I, on the other hand, if you are, because that's more on the side of like being too lean, you can probably spot some of those side effects in your ability, your inability to sustain work outputs over the case of multiple training sessions and multiple days, and effects on sleep and mood and things like that. But then on the other side, being like a heavier athlete, I think that that's a little bit of a trickier thing to unravel. I myself am on the heavier side of athletes in CrossFit. I think I'm the heaviest athlete to actually have been to the CrossFit Games.
What do you weigh?
When I went to the games, I was 103.5 kilos,
How tall are you?
6'2", so 189 centimeters.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm now around 101, 101.5. So I've cut down from that. And but I think that, and it's a tricky one, because obviously the heavier that you are, that's more weight to carry around for every single movement. And the only place it potentially gives you an advantage is on the powerlifts and the weightlifting movements and like the heavy carries. But a bigger person, a taller athlete, or with a bigger frame naturally is going to carry more weight. So it's a case of balancing out like what weight is good for me so that I feel good and can have really good training sessions. I can recover from my training sessions mood wise. Like I feel good in myself. I feel energetic throughout the day. I have fairly like stable appetite and stable mood throughout the day. I sleep well. These are all things that are going to contribute towards your training and your performance, your development, far more than losing 3 kilos, being unhappy, moody, not being able to sleep well, not having energy for training sessions. But strict handstand push-ups are maybe a bit easier. Like it's not a very good trade-off. So you kind of like, you have to balance those two things. And I think that's a tricky thing for bigger athletes.
Talking about you to end the podcast, you said you were focusing on your athletic goals this year.
Yes.
What are your goals at this point in time?
Get back to the CrossFit Games.
How's that looking so far?
Tough.
How did talk us through the season, starting with the Open? What do you think of it, and then how did it go for you?
So this is my after taking a year and a half, just over a year and a half out, this is my first year back competing properly.
Okay. Yeah.
And that started with the Madrid Championships late last year, and then another competition in Marbella after that. So that part of the season was good. It was a nice reintroduction back into competing and showed that I haven't lost all of my fitness.
What do you mean? You took a year and a half off.
There's a year and a half of just lifting weights and getting thick, and then about half a year of cutting that weight back down again.
How heavy did you get?
I went up to 110.
Nice.
Yeah. And it was like, it wasn't 110. Like I just let myself go. Like as I said, like I came from an endurance background. So yeah. I deliberately was like, I'm doing minimal conditioning. I'm sick of sitting on machines and running, like, and doing CrossFit. I just want to lift weights and I want to get really strong. So I planned, it was an intentional bulk, as an intentional like hypertrophy and strength and peaking phase. And it went well. I really enjoyed it. I built a lot of muscle, got a lot stronger. And then returning to CrossFit, obviously, I will cut some of that weight down so I can actually do a handstand push-up and a muscle-up again. So the Open, I really enjoyed, and quarterfinals. I have always performed really badly in online competition and very well in in-person competition, conversely. And so those online stages have always been the toughest stages for me, is actually getting to the competition. And then when I get to the competition, like, I usually perform in a way that I'm very happy with. I like the variation with the Open. I like the introduction of the wall facing handstand push up in the quarterfinals, and I also liked the kind of like the patterning with the tests as well, with that test one being an increasing, I'm trying to remember it now, increasing complexity on the gymnastics movement.
Yes, yeah.
and decreasing load on the front squat. And then test five being, again, an increasing complexity on the gymnastics movement, but an increasing load on the barbell. I really liked how those two like opposites of each other. It was a cool test. GHD setups is something I've been working on a lot, so it was nice to have a high volume, like hip flexion, ab flexion movement.
With a machine that you know.
With a machine that I know, yeah. That I actually hate now as well, because I've spent so many hours on it too. I really enjoyed all the tests. I like the variety. I like the introduction of some new movements. I like the challenges. I like the direction that Bosman's is taking it in. Gymnastics is obviously something that's, for a guy my size, is a challenge, and so that's forcing me to get better at the stuff that I'm not so good at. I like the direction that it's going. It's like providing some new and fun challenges.
What are you looking forward to at the next stage of competition?
I think it's been so long since I've, apart from Madrid and Marbella, it's been so long since I've competed against my peers, that I'm just looking forward to getting back out there and getting back on the competition floor with them, especially as it's now looking a lot like regionals used to look. And that was my first like official CrossFit competition. And so that's probably the one that I have like the most, I don't know, like sentimental memories of as well. So I'm looking forward to it, like getting that regionals feel back again.
There's going to be a lot of athletes too.
There is going to be a lot of athletes.
How do you see that playing out compared to last year, where it was 30 and 30 and now it's 60?
I like it because it's, I think it doesn't really get more fair than having all of the athletes from one region doing the same tests at the same competition. I think that there's something to be said about like having athletes at two different competitions doing two different tests, two different weekends, but then taking up spots in the same region. Whereas this time we're all there at the same time. I think it's going to be like probably bigger than any other like regional style tests that we've ever seen before, because I don't know anywhere that we've had this many athletes at this level for all from the Europe region. Everyone's there.
Yeah, that's going to be pretty exciting. I very
Yeah,
much
so
look
I'm really
forward
looking forward to it.
to the next stages. And like you said, the direction that Boz has taken the programming, it's different enough, I guess, than what we've seen in the past that it's noticeable, and it's, I guess, it's interesting. Now, do you see how much do you pay attention or listen to what's going on over the on the TTT side of things? Do you listen to what those guys put
Oh,
out for
training
content?
big time.
Yeah.
I listened to some of the stuff they put out. Not so much stuff recently. I think the last one I started was they were doing an interview with Brent, and I think I've started listening to bits of that. I followed quite closely Evan Pycon a while ago, and the stuff that they released on the TTT Classroom too. I think they're great guys, put out some really good stuff.
And one thing that they talk about quite frequently is the unknown unknowable parameter of competition and how that tenet, it's not even a principle, it's just a way that the sport was imagined in the beginning, how it might be hampering the advancement of the sport itself and the professional aspect of the sport by, you know, not having information ahead of time. Maybe the standards are changing quite frequently depending on the movement, and that's not always clear. How do you see the unknown and knowable aspect of the sport from a competition and professionalization standpoint?
I think that the unknown and unknowable is such a core aspect of the sport and such a like such a nice feature of the sport that it's a great thing to have. It's such an integral part of it, like character of the sport, that I don't think that it is something that should be done away with. I don't even think it needs to be changed. I think the issue isn't necessarily with the unknown and unknowable. I think the issue is more to do with the communication beforehand, the time of that communication, like how far in advance we are informed about certain things. And also the consistency as well, both in terms of those two things, the timely communication, but also in terms of things as simple as judging, and movement standards, and both establishing movement standards, but also keeping movement standards and judging movement standards as well. I think that if they're introducing new movements and they're changing movement standards or new workout formats, I think these are all like, they're all interesting and fun and engaging things to happen in the sport, and it provides like new and updated challenges for us as athletes. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think more is the issue is them not having the movement standards confirmed and out, ready for people to see and practice ahead of time, than being consistent between, for instance, individual and team athletes. Then I think these are all probably bigger, the real issues in terms of the unknown and the unknowable. For instance, at the CrossFit Games, like not, it doesn't matter that you don't know the event the day, the next day, like the exact movements of the event the next day. It's the same for everyone. It's the nature of the test. What does matter is having to stay up until 11 o'clock at night to receive the email to tell you that you need to be in at 6 o'clock in the morning. Like that's more of the issue. So I think that the unknown and the unknowable is something that just needs to be better managed if they want to continue with it.
I really like that answer, and I appreciate you sharing on that and on everything else on the podcast. It was a great pleasure to have you on. For those that want to know more about what you do, where can they find out more information?
At Sharonke on Instagram, and hopefully on the podium at Berlin.
Let's go. With
Thank you very
Victor.
much for having me,
With
Sean.
Victor. I'll see you there with Victor on the podium.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Take care, man. Thanks so much for for coming on the show. It was great.
Thanks a lot for having me, Sean. Take care, man.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you would like to support the podcast, please take a few moments to leave a written review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. If you want to watch this episode again, you can find the full video recording on my YouTube channel. You'll also find hundreds of hours of free content, all my podcasts, my thoughts of the day, structured presentations, and more. So don't wait, go subscribe, and I'll see you in the next episode. Take care.